Thank you, Mr. Troyer. I will add my compliments to the special music. Beautiful job on the flute. pretty piece and very well performed. So thanks to Anita and Judy for that. And again, wanted to thank all those in our congregation that were involved in the virtual children's choir. We enjoyed seeing so many of our families involved with that. I won't comment on their actions on the screen. Some are just so precious, you can't help but really, really enjoy that. God tells us in His Word, in the Psalms, children are a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward. Today I'm going to do something a little different and give a sermon to the children. Well, you're all children, so it's for everybody. The rest of you are certainly welcome to listen in and glean from the message as well, but what I'd like to do is examine the early life of one of the people in the Bible, a young man called David. David is one of the few people in the Bible whose entire life story is recorded, from childhood all the way through to his death in old age. It's a rare event to have so much of one life recorded in the Bible. So today I'd like to retell the story of David's early years so that our children might be able to imitate what he did well. And if we're successful in this, the rest of us may just learn a few things, or at least be reminded of a few things that will spiritually benefit us as well. There are things we can learn from David's early years that will not only help our teens and our young adults, but will be great lessons for all of us, young and old, male and female. We'll identify some of the foundational things that set the stage for David's success, for him to become the greatest king of Israel. We might say the reason he was successful was set early during his youthful years. So we'll start right in. Turn with me to 1 Samuel chapter 16. As you know, in essence, 1 Samuel is the story of David, 2 Samuel the story of Solomon, and the other kings go on from there. What we have here is the first mention of this young man, David. Now, we won't go into all the details as to how we might know, but it's universally accepted that David was probably a teenager at this time when we're introduced to him by the book of Samuel. Some would say it seems to be that David was probably around age 16. So that's an interesting observation. Let's look at what God begins to say. The first lesson that I've jotted down that I'd like our children to remember is that David obeyed his parents. Now, if you're 10 or 11, you may be saying, oh, great. But there's great benefit in obeying your parents. We'll see about that. 1 Samuel 16 and verse 1. Now the Eternal said to Samuel, how long will you mourn for Saul? So our children remember the story. Saul was king. Saul disobeyed God and rebelled against God. And so he was slated to be replaced. Well, not right away, but over the course of time, he would be taken out of that kingship and someone else put in. How long will you mourn for Saul, seeing I've rejected him from reigning over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and go. I'm sending you to Jesse, the Bethlehemite, for I have provided myself a king among his sons. Jesse had a whole boatload of boys. Now, there may have been a boatload of girls to go along with that, but there are all these sons born to Jesse in Bethlehem. And so Samuel was to go there and ordain a new king, anoint a new king. Samuel said, well, how can I go there? If Saul hears it, he'll kill me. But the Eternal said, and again, it gives you an idea of the kind of environment that Saul set up. You cross me and you die. So the Lord said, take a heifer with you and say, I've come to sacrifice to the Lord. In other words, God said, I'll give you a reason to go to Bethlehem. and that is to give a sacrifice to me. And if anyone asks, that's what you'll tell them. You don't have to tell them the second part of that story. Then invite, verse 3, Jesse to the sacrifice. And I'll show you what you shall do. You shall anoint for me the one I name to you. So one of Jesse's sons would be the next king. So Samuel did what the Eternal said and went to Bethlehem. And the elders of the town trembled at his coming and said, "Do you come peaceably?" And he said, "Peaceably. I've come to sacrifice to the Eternal. Sanctify yourselves and come with me to the sacrifice." Then he consecrated Jesse and his sons and invited them to the sacrifice. So they come to this kind of official ceremony where this ox would be slayed and burnt on the altar that they had set up. So it was, verse 6, that when they came, that he looked at Eliab and said, "Surely the Lord's anointed is before him." So Samuel looked at these stair-step sons and looked at Eliab, and I don't know exactly, but for Samuel to have this reaction, Eliab must have been the picture of humanity, the picture of manhood, tall, dark, handsome, muscular, square jaw, hair. I'm more concerned about these days than I was before. But he just looked the part of a king. Probably had a six-pack, and I'm not talking about beer. You know, the guy was built. Samuel looked at him and said, "Clearly, this is the guy. This is clearly God's anointed, must be standing before him, and I'll go ahead and anoint him." But no, verse 7, the Lord said to Samuel, "Do not look at his appearance or at his physical stature, because I have refused him." The Hebrew literally is, "I have rejected him." We'll come to see there's something about Eliab's character that was distasteful to God, and it had to do with arrogance and superiority. He probably looked the part, and it sounds like he acted the part. You ever known a person like that, that seems to be the picture of humanity or femininity, and they act the part, they know they are, and they're about to let everybody else know they are? It's pretty sad, a little disgusting. You see why God would reject that kind of attitude. God goes on to say to Samuel in the middle of verse 7, "For the Lord does not see as man sees, for man looks at the outward appearance, but the Eternal looks at the heart." So there was something about Eliab's heart that was not right. So our young people, when they strive to obey their parents, they strive to do so with a right heart. The heart is what is the most important aspect of obedience to parents and obedience to God. Because we all know we can obey our parents in a rotten attitude. "You told me to take out the trash, I'm taking out the trash." Well, thanks for being so obedient. But where's the heart? I want to help the family. So you have an Eliab who might have obeyed. You have a David that obeys from the heart. He agrees with it. He's willing to follow. God looks at the heart. So something special about David's heart. Jesse called Abinadab and made him pass before Samuel. This must have been number 2. So you have them in order of age. Eliab walks by. Samuel thinks this is the guy. God says, "No, I've rejected him." The next one, Abinadab, comes by. "No, not him either." He said, "Neither has the Lord chosen this one." So Samuel's waiting for this indication from God. 1 goes by, 2 goes by, 3 goes by. God says nothing. And he gets all the way to the end. Verse 9, Jesse made Shammah pass by. Number 3. And he said, "Neither has the Eternal chosen this one." Didn't hear anything from God. Verse 10, then Jesse made 7 of his sons pass before Samuel. No, the 3 must have been the most impressive, the oldest 3. And then he passed the next 4 by. None of them won God's favor. Samuel said to Jesse, "The Lord has not chosen these." Now he's confused. Jesse's probably confused. Verse 11, Samuel said to Jesse, "Are all the young men here?" And he knew what he heard from God. "I'm going to have you anoint one of Jesse's sons, the next king." Now, all seven go by and no anointing, no message from God. So Jesse says, then he said, "There remains yet the youngest. And there he is keeping sheep." In other words, he's not here now. He's out tending to the sheep. So what was David doing? He was doing exactly what his father had asked him to, and that was take care of the sheep. Now, we could speculate all day long on what was Jesse thinking. I mean, here's probably one of the most spectacular events, maybe of their lives, the prophet of God coming to their city, inviting their family to this sacrifice, and the sheep are more important to Jesse? Put the kid out there? He's the little guy. He's the youngest. He's unimportant. Is that what they were thinking? Well, we don't know. But if you've ever felt as a young person slighted by your parents, hang in there. Parents are not perfect. It's not said that parents are perfect. And there's never a time in the scripture where parents are condemned for not being perfect. We'll all do the best that we can. Sometimes we don't do it very well. But that's life. You'll survive. It'll be okay. Samuel asked, "Are there any more?" Oh yeah, there's the youngest out there keeping the sheep. The rest of the verse says, "And Samuel said to Jesse, 'Send and bring him, for we will not sit down till he comes here.'" So part of course the sacrifice was eating of that sacrifice, depending on the kind of sacrifice that it was. And this was one that they probably would partake in. So we're not going to sit down to eat until he comes. So David was obedient to his father. You think David would have wanted to be there to see Samuel, to see this sacrifice, to participate in it? Well, you bet he would have. This was a big deal. I mean, the elders of the village said, "Samuel's coming. Are we in trouble?" This was a big event. For David to be stuck out with the sheep was kind of an insult, a little bit. Or at least, if not an insult, it was shown that he wasn't considered to be very important along the way. Well, sometimes we may feel we're unimportant, but we're very important to God. So we learn the second lesson, that David was yielded to God. More important than being yielded to his parents is that he was yielded to God. Notice verse 12. David was yielded to God. "So he," Jesse, "sent and brought him," David, "in." Now it describes David just a little bit. Now he was ruddy. Different translations or interpreters look at that word and say it seems to mean reddish. So was it his rosy cheeks? You know, he's a kid, maybe 13, 14, 15, 16 years old at this point. He had these kind of childlike look to him yet, ruddy, you know, kind of red cheeks with bright eyes. Literally, the word is beautiful eyes. I mean, you look at this kid, he was striking. It says, "and good looking." So he's a handsome little guy, young man. Now, again, as a 16-year-old or 15-year-old, many men at that age, young men, mature. Into their full, I mean, most of the maturing emotionally in our generation comes later, but physically, some of these kids grow to be big kids at age 13 or 14. And all of a sudden you think, wow. In fact, this last week I was visiting with a family who have a 16-year-old son. This guy is huge. I mean, he's huge. Broader shoulders, much bigger than I am. Broad shoulders, muscular, looks good, works on the farm. Just a fine young man. 16 years old. Was David like that? We're not told. He wasn't the runt of the litter necessarily, but he was still a kid, still a teenager, we would say. But that was a good thing. The Lord said, "Arise, anoint him, for this is the one." And when I say David was yielded to God, he didn't say, no. "I do the sheep thing. I'm not doing this other stuff. What do you mean? Anoint me." I mean, Samuel would have had to explain what he was doing. that he was going to, God has asked me to anoint you as the next king of Israel. He didn't fight Samuel over this. He was yielded to God. And if that's what God decides, then so be it. He probably didn't understand it in great depth yet. He would come to, but he certainly would have understood the rumors going around about Saul and his behavior. Verse 13, Samuel then took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brothers. Now, if we're reading Eliab correctly, what do you suppose his reaction to this was? Snot-nosed little kid. I mean, I've got a couple older brothers, and I'm sure at times they thought that about me, snot-nosed little kid. Maybe they still do, I don't know. But point is, later on, Eliab accuses David of being arrogant and haughty and almost disobedient. And you see, what Eliab really is accusing David of is probably what he was doing himself. So, in the midst of his brothers, they see this, they hear what Samuel says. Was it an out loud verbal blessing and anointing the way we just did with the little children? Maybe. We're not told whether Samuel spoke out loud at that point, but it wouldn't be unusual. It'd probably be pretty likely that that was the case. And it says, the Spirit of the Eternal came upon David from that day forward. So God can give our children extra help through his Holy Spirit. If we're yielded to God, God can provide special help. And that's a wonderful thing. Not to be king of Israel, obviously, but to be a future king and priest. So David didn't volunteer, but he did not resist. He wanted what God wanted. He was confident that God would provide. He was content to follow God's lead. So if we likewise yield to God and trust him, he'll place us where he wants us to be. So from that day forward, the Spirit of the Lord came upon David. So Samuel arose and went to Ramah. He went back home. A third lesson we learn from David for our young people is this. David took advantage of his free time. David took advantage of his free time. What do we mean by that? Well, it is clear that we have more free time, quote unquote, up to our 18th birthday than at any other time in our lives. We don't normally have to go work a job to support ourselves and to support the family. So we actually have more time on our hands than at any other time of our life. And it's tragic to see so many in today's world frittering that away in wasteful activities that do virtually nothing for the child or for society as a whole in the long run. David was different. Notice 1 Samuel 16 here in verse 14. We'll pick up where we left off. The Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and a distressing spirit from the Eternal troubled him. Now, we're not saying that God sent this spirit upon Saul, but when God removed his spirit, now Saul is open to this distressing spirit. So it's said as if God sent it, but God is allowing it. It was Saul's behavior that brought on this melancholy, depressive spirit. It's almost so sad to see how it almost destroys Saul. Eventually it will. Verse 15, Saul's servants said to him, "Surely a distressing spirit from God is troubling you." And again, it's stated as if it's from God because God's not kept the hedge up around Saul the way he had before. "Let our master now," verse 16, "command your servants who are before you to seek out a man who is a skillful player on the harp. And it shall be that when he will play with his hand, when the distressing spirit from God is upon you, and you shall be well." So Saul said to his servants, you've all heard that music soothes the savage beast. And there is music that can be very soothing. And there is music that stirs wrong things in a person's heart and mind. And Christians need to have the discernment to know which is which. And that's a large topic of and by itself. But music is a force, it's a power, and we have to be aware of its power. Saul said to his servants, "Provide me now a man," verse 17, "who can play well, bring him to me." And one of the servants answered and said, "Look, I have seen a son of Jesse, the Bethlehemite, who is skillful in playing." How did David become skillful in playing? He used his free time wisely to develop a skill, to develop a talent, rather than just fritter it away. David didn't have access to screens the way we do today, that if we're not careful, we can plop our children in front of screens, and instead of interacting with them, instead of giving them opportunities to learn and to grow, and frankly, demanding certain things of them or expecting certain things of them, we can simply dump them off to an electronic babysitter. We want to be careful about that. As parents, we want to reflect on who is teaching our children. What are they learning during that time? It's not to say that there isn't a time just to have leisure. That's certainly true. But leisure should be something that's productive as well as leisurely along the way. So David became a skilled musician because he practiced. It takes practice. You can ask any who are musicians, did it just happen? No, I picked up, as an Edomite, I picked up that flute last week and boom, I was able to play. Obviously not. When JC plays special music, oh, never practiced. I just looked at that music and out it comes. Well, of course not. Practice is involved. Playing over the course of time. Some say, not in the scripture, but according to tradition, David actually developed musical instruments. Now, maybe that's the case. Nonetheless, he used his time wisely, not just to fritter things away. So he was a skillful player on the harp. What else did he do in his free time? He was skillful, in the middle of verse 18, in playing, a mighty man of valor. So you know what else he practiced? He practiced his swordsmanship. He practiced his slingmanship. Learned how to use that sling. Can you imagine David as a young boy standing up those little piles of stones, walking back first 10 yards, whew, missed, whew, hour after hour after hour, until he sets those stones up, and then at 20 yards, bang, and then at 30 yards, bang, he's able to do it. So it's not just play, but it's play with a purpose, with a value to it. So as parents, we want to be sure that as our children grow, that we're working with them in that regard, that there's play with purpose. Well, sure, there's just play and enjoyment. There's got to be some of that, absolutely. But that there's play with purpose. There's something of value that is going to be the result of all these hours spent. So David became a man of valor, a man of war, it says. But it also then says he was prudent in speech. Something parents are working with our children. Children, have you ever been told, "Don't sass me"? Maybe that's not a word that your parents used. Some are shaking their heads. Yes, I heard that. "Don't talk back to me." Those are some things. David learned to be prudent in his speech. What does prudent mean? It means exercising good judgment, exercising care in the circumstance. So our parents are working with their children. No, don't sass, don't talk back, just do. Just go ahead and do it. Now, David sometimes may have learned that because of having seven older brothers. I learned early on that you don't talk back to your brothers either, at least the older ones. And I'm sure my youngest brother probably has mental scars, emotional scars from, we're going to teach you, just sad, but sometimes true. So he learned to be prudent, careful in his speech. Don't just say the first thing that comes out of your mouth. He took advantage of his free time to maybe even think about how to speak to his brothers, how to speak to his father, how to speak to others. Goes on to say in the rest of verse 18, he was a handsome person and the Lord is with him. So what's interesting is that everybody seemed to know these things about David. So when the proverb says, even a child is known by his works, that certainly seemed to be the case. Because one in Saul's court said, man, I had heard this kid and he was awesome. Talk about a skilled player. And not only that, he knows how to handle himself. He knows how to use a sword. He knows how to use a sling. The kid is sharp. He's good looking. He'd be an asset to your court, Saul, and it would be very helpful for you. So our young people, our children, we want them to be known by their attitudes, by their works, by their skills as they grow, as they mature. So use free time in a wise manner. Parents certainly can help with that over the course of time. We also understand a fourth thing I think we can glean from David's life that we want our children to understand is that David was personable. What does that mean? It means David was nice. Now, we're not talking about personality here. We're not talking about an extrovert versus an introvert. We all know extroverts who are personable. We also probably know extroverts who are difficult to stomach sometimes. Would you just turn off for a minute? It's like too much. You're all looking at me. We all know introverts who are personable. But we also know introverts who are so painfully shy that they want nothing to do with people. And that's not a right balance either. So we're talking about being personable here. David was personable. When he was explained that I've seen this young man, he's really skillful. He's a man of war. He knows how to handle himself. He knows how to speak. He'll be careful with what he says. This is the kind of person you want in your court, Saul. You want helping you. And was David obnoxious? Notice in chapter 16 here, beginning in verse 19. Saul sent messengers to Jesse and said, send me your son David, who is with the sheep. That was David's lot. Get out there with the sheep. We know where he is. Where was he when Samuel came? With the sheep. Where was he when Saul asked for him? With the sheep. He was doing his job, carrying out his responsibility. So Jesse took a donkey, loaded with bread, a skin of wine, that would have been a goat skin full of wine, and a young goat. Goats, as we said, often get a bad rap. But a gift to a king was a goat here. And sent them by his son David to Saul. So you don't just send your son, you send a gift to the king as well. So David came to Saul and stood before him. And he, Saul, loved him, David, greatly. Now, if David was an obnoxious, arrogant little boy, would Saul have loved him? I mean, there was nothing about David to dislike. He was personable. He could speak well. When Saul said, I am so angry, David wouldn't have said, you crazy old man, you have nothing to be angry about. He said, well, let me play some music. See if that would help. He just knew how to handle himself. And I am so impressed by some of our teenagers. They know how to handle themselves with others, with dignity and with calm, and that's a great asset. He loved him greatly, and he became his armor bearer. Now, we're not told whether David actually went out to battle with Saul as an armor bearer, but when Saul made his official appearances, it may be that David was there with him. Saul and everyone else just really liked David. He was a personable young man. Verse 22. Then Saul sent to Jesse, saying, please let David stand before me, for he has found favor in my sight. He went through the probationary period, And Saul said, I want him in my court full time. He's a help to me. David was not trying to take over or be in charge. He was simply trying to help in the best way that he could, to serve his king. And that was a wonderful attribute. Verse 23, and so it was, whenever the Spirit from God was upon Saul, that David would take a harp and play it with his hand. Then Saul would become refreshed and well, and the distressing spirit would depart from him. So the beautiful music that David was able to play certainly helped. Now again, when you think about a harp, these probably were five-string harps, vertical as opposed to horizontal, the way we tend to have stringed instruments today. Have you ever heard rock and roll or that played on a harp? So that's not what David was playing. Now again, I have nothing about rock and roll. That's a whole other story. I happen to like certain rock, and maybe I shouldn't, but I happen to like some things. But the point was, this is soothing music. This was something that settled Saul. This was not rock. It was something settling. Many of you probably saw during the feast, if it was played at your feast site, one of the pieces of special music was by a 16-year-old in our church out in Colorado, playing the pedal harp. Beautiful, beautiful music she was able to produce with that wonderful instrument. I couldn't help but think of David calming Saul when you see that beautiful music being played. So David was personable. We want our children to strive to be personable. One child asked, how can I be kind if I'm not allowed to talk to strangers? So again, we want a balance there. Don't make your children afraid. They should be able to be safe in a place like this and talk to quote-unquote strangers. Teach them to talk to adults. It's a very important skill to learn. Teach them to talk to adults. Not to be intimidated or afraid, or simply run the other direction, but to truly engage with others. That's a great skill for our children to learn as they grow up. Let's go on from there. Number five, David was responsible and dependable. And we want our young children to learn to be responsible and dependable. And I love to see in our congregation the responsibility that our children have taken on all by themselves, and that is to collect hymnals after services. And I'm kind of sorry we're not using hymnals right now. We will get back to that, by the way. Again, the CDC recently, this last week, has said it's very unlikely to get the virus from surfaces. Very unlikely. Almost unheard of. So at some point, we'll be able to use hymnals again. And one of the things we've always enjoyed seeing is all the little ones. Amen. Finish singing. Put the hymnal down. And it's like a beehive. Bzz, 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 and they're all out. Who can get the most hymnals and get them back to the hymnal area in time? I mean, that's awesome to see their desire to be responsible. This is my job. And I'll see how many I can carry before I have to drop them off to those responsible for them. So that's a wonderful thing to see. We want to provide opportunities for our children to do those kinds of things, to help in various areas where they have interests, especially. David was responsible. We saw again and again he was out with the sheep doing what he was told. But notice in chapter 17, drop down to verse 14. David was the youngest. David's three oldest brothers had gone to war with Saul against the Philistines, the three that we had named by name earlier in the sermon. Eliab, Abinadab, I think, and Shema. David was the youngest, verse 14, and the three oldest followed Saul. But David occasionally went and returned from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. So here he was standing before Saul. Saul gets in this melancholy, depressive attitude. David plays the harp, kind of brings him out of that. So now Saul is at the military camp. He's very involved with things. So David is able to go back home and do what? Goof around? No, he'd take care of the sheep. Still his responsibility. to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem, verse 16. And the Philistine drew near. What Philistine is being talked about here? Well, it's the famous Goliath of Gath, this giant 9 to 10 foot tall monster of a man, was coming and threatening Israel. So the two armies face, as was often the case at that time, two armies would face off against each other. They'd send out their biggest and toughest, and they would taunt each other and then finally decide, well, maybe we can settle this by just the two heroes fighting. And whoever wins, then the others have to leave, and we're going to take what we want, and we'll kill you all, that kind of thing. So Goliath is sent out, and he was absolutely the picture of fright to the Israelites. So Philistine drew out, presented himself 40 days, morning and evening. And his attitude was despicable. He cursed God. He cursed the Israelites. He cursed the Israelite army. He made fun of them. He taunted them. Jesse then said to David, verse 17, Jesse said to his son David, take now for your brothers an ephah of this dried grain and these 10 loaves and run to your brothers at the camp. Now, I'm not sure that Jesse meant literally run, but you begin to get this picture of David, this young, rosy-cheeked, ruddy. When it says ruddy, was he red-haired? Some say, well, must have been red-haired. It would have been very unusual for an Israelite, a Bethlehemite, a Jew, to be red-headed. But that's possible. Nonetheless, you got this rosy-cheeked young man, but you get the sense that, boy, he knows how to use a sword. He knows how to use a knife. He knows how to use a sling. He can run. You get the sense of this wiry young man who is tough as nails, out there with the sheep 24 hours a day, and he's going to run to take these supplies down to his brothers. Then verse 18, and carry these 10 cheeses to the captain of their 1,000 and see how your brothers fare and bring back news of them. Tell me how it's going. So Jesse gave him this responsibility, and he knew that David would carry it out. There was never a question. He didn't say, you know, I've asked you to do this before and you didn't do what you were asked. No, David was responsible and dependable. As a 16-year-old, was able to easily carry out these directives from his father. So take your brothers the food. And again, at that time, armies were often taken care of by their families who would send food. They didn't have MREs, you know, meals ready to eat for the soldiers. You, in some cases, were on your own. So send this food to the boys and a donation for the general cause to go into the food storehouse, we might say, for all the soldiers. Bring back news. So he trusted David to take care of this, and certainly David was dependable to do so. Verse 19, now Saul and they all, and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. So David rose early in the morning, left the sheep, not by themselves, he was responsible. He left the sheep with a keeper, one of the servants most likely, and took the things and went as Jesse had commanded him. We said earlier, David obeyed his parents. He was responsible. Can we say that if we're a teenager? If we're asked to carry out a responsibility, are we willing to do that? And do we do it? Are we dependable? It's wonderful to see our little grandson when my wife says, Conrad, I can depend on you. To see that little face light up and, you know, that kind of straightening of the spine, mentally speaking, and okay, all right. There's something wonderful about that. So we want our children to learn that as they grow older, I should say. David rose early, left the sheep with a keeper, took the things as Jesse had commanded, and then he came to the camp as an army was going out to the fight, shouting for the battle. So they're going to line up in array across this valley. They'll shout and yell and try to intimidate each other until one side or the other breaks, and then maybe the battle would start. So David was dependable and responsible. A sixth thing from David's early years that we can learn is that David defended God's honor. David defended God's honor. Now, you and I both would say, well, God doesn't need us to defend him. And it's not for us. I should say, it's not for God that we defend God's honor. It's for us. David was going to stand for God to show God his faithfulness, to show God that he loved him, show God that he appreciated him. Sometimes we have the opportunity to stand for God's honor. And it's important that we do so, that we don't shirk that responsibility and try to hide the fact that we worship the great God of the universe and all that that entails and all the beliefs that that entails. David defended God's honor. We'll see that in verse 21. For Israel and the Philistines had drawn up in battle array, army against army. So again, you can picture in your mind the lines across this valley, and they're looking at each other, and they're banging their shields, and they're trying to intimidate one another. And then, of course, the monster comes out, and Israel's scared spitless, as the saying goes. David left his supplies in the hand of the supply keeper. What did he carry? 10 cheeses. So are these rounds of cheeses? I mean, they probably would have been goat cheese. We're not told, but he didn't just dump them on the side and run over there. He took care of his responsibility. He left the supplies in the hands of the supply keeper, ran to the army, and came and greeted his brothers. So he carried out his responsibility. What did Jesse ask him to do? Go visit your brothers, give them this food, and find out how they're doing. Bring me a report. Verse 23, then as he talked with them, there was the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, coming up from the armies of the Philistines. So again, they're lined up across this valley, and out steps this giant of a man, 9 to 10 feet tall. Talks about his spear being, in essence, what we would call a telephone pole in diameter. This was a monster of a man. A few years ago at preteen camp, this was one of our themes, the Goliaths of the world. And so one of our ladies made a full-size Goliath out of paper, of course. And then we had each of the children, if they wanted to stand next to Goliath and have their picture taken. Of course, I did have to have my picture taken with David and Goliath. It meant a lot to me. But to see that he was almost twice as tall? I mean, just incredible. The breadth of this man's shoulders must have been just stunning. You think of the biggest man you know and multiply it by a bit, and then you get Goliath. So a very stunning genetic misfit, we might say. But nonetheless, very powerful man. So Goliath comes out, and it says, and he spoke according to the same words. So David heard them. So he happened to, what was he doing? He was doing what his father asked. He came to his brothers to see how they were doing so he could take back a report. And he just happens to be there when Goliath walks out and starts cursing God, cursing the armies of Israel, belittling them all, saying, we're going to cut you to pieces. We're going to eat you for lunch. Whatever his saying was, he was a nasty man. And David heard that and could hardly believe his ears, that nobody seemed to be reacting to this. So verse 24, all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were dreadfully afraid. What struck David was not the size of this man, but the audacity that he would have to curse the great God of the universe, to curse the armies of Israel, and how foolish they were to worship this God. That's what stuck in David's head. So he was going to defend God's honor. You can't say that about God. It's not true. How dare you say that? Verse 25. So the men of Israel said, have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he has come up to defy Israel. And it shall be the man who kills him, the king will enrich with great riches and give him his daughter and give his father's house exemption from taxes in Israel. Now that may have been something Saul did spread around the army. The person who's willing to take on this guy will be greatly rewarded. But David hears this and realizes that this attitude is completely wrong. You're worried about a reward? Did you hear what this guy said about God, about us, about Israel? David spoke to the men who stood by him, saying, "What? What shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel?" Was that the point, the reward? You're asking what's going to be given to the... He said, "For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" What struck David was the inappropriateness of this Gentile's speech, of this monster on the other side of the line. How dare he say those things about God, about God's people, about God's nation? David was going to stand and defend God's honor. Now we learn another lesson as we go along, that David's zeal, maybe number 7 here, David's zeal inspired others. I mean, when they heard David speak, they knew in their heart of hearts that this was true. This was right. This is how I should feel. He inspired that in them. Well, the people answered, well, in this manner, saying, "So shall it be done for the man who kills him." Again, they're not thinking straight. They're thinking about the reward. But as they heard David speak, it became obvious that David wasn't running for office, but he was so disgusted by the attitude that Goliath had shown that he couldn't help but do you hear what this guy's saying? Can we just stand here and let that be said about God, about our people, about the armies of Israel? How can we let that stand? Now, verse 28, Eliab, his oldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men. Now, I believe, in my personal opinion, Eliab in his heart of hearts knew that David was right. Instead of admitting that, he yells at his little brother. Eliab's anger was aroused against David. Why would you be angry when stating the truth, when you hear the truth stated? Well, was Eliab thinking, again, trying to psychoanalyze the poor guy, was he thinking, that's the way I should be. That's what I should have said. That's how I should have felt. But he didn't. So Eliab's anger, maybe that's why, it was aroused against David. And he said, "Why did you come down here?" As if it was just a punky little brother trying to get himself involved. "Why did you come down here? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness?" Like, what did that have to do with anything? See, Eliab is feeling, in my opinion, guilty. He should be the one. He's the tall, dark, and handsome. He's got the six-pack. He's got the big biceps. He's the one that ought to be saying, "Come on, we need to take care of this Gentile who's defying God." Who did you leave the sheep with in the wilderness? Then he says something just unbelievable. "I know your pride and the insolence of your heart." Often, it seems that the righteous are accused of the very thing that's in the heart of the accuser. And that certainly seems to be the case here. The pride and insolence may have been in Eliab's heart, not in David's. "For you have come down to see the battle." You're just a kid. You want to be around the excitement of the battle. So it's kind of insulting the way Eliab obviously spoke with David. But David's words rang true. In verse 29, David said, What have I done now? Is there not a cause?" In other words, you have no cause to be angry with me. Literally, "Is it not a word?" is what David said. So David, in essence, is saying, "What have I done now? Isn't what I'm saying true?" It's not a matter I want to come down and just see the excitement of a battle. Is it not a word? Is this not the case? And of course, Eliab couldn't answer that. Verse 30, "Then he turned from him," his brother, "toward another, and said the same thing. And these people answered him as the first ones." Now, again, it's very difficult to understand exactly what verse 30 is saying. But it seems that the reputation now of what David is saying, he's standing for God. He's standing for the truth. And it starts to excite people. And it goes all the way to the king that there is somebody out here who means it, who believes that this man should be faced. What was the rest doing? They were all running. Nobody can stand before this Goliath. So the word gets to the king. There's a guy out here that says he would stand before Goliath. And that was the first of all of Israel. So it goes, he's inspiring. He sees that this is the way I truly feel, and it's obvious to everyone. There was passion in David's speech and his discussion of this. So the words which David spoke, verse 31, were heard. They reported them to Saul, and he, Saul, sent for David. Then David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine." There was no haughtiness here. He desperately, in his heart of hearts, knew that what Goliath was saying was sinful and wrong and insulting to God, and he was not going to allow that to stand. And he knew God would take care of him. He knew God would deliver this uncircumcised Gentile, as he called him, into my hand. And Saul looked at this kid and he was stunned, no doubt. Saul said to David, "You're not able to go against this Philistine and fight with him." I mean, how much David knew Saul and Saul knew David at this point, where in the story this all fits, various commentators will argue about. But this is my harp player. No, you're not. I mean, Saul was convicted by David's words. He was standing for God, for God's honor. Saul knew in his heart of hearts that was right. But he said, "David, you're just a kid. You're a youth. You're a teen. This guy's been a man of war from his youth. He's been a soldier longer than you've been alive. You don't stand a chance." But David said to Saul in verse 34, in essence, "You underestimate me." David said to Saul, "Your servant used to keep his father's sheep. And when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb out of the flock, I went out after it and struck it." I mean, it was just as wrong for that bear or that lion to steal a sheep as it is for this Gentile to insult God. And it says, David said, delivered the lamb from its mouth. And when it arose against me, I caught it by its beard and struck and killed it. Now, we're not told how that happened. I have my own theory. When David goes out to meet Goliath, what does he take with him? Well, we know the famous sling. But what we don't often think about is what else he took. He took his staff. And if I were a betting man, you don't just wait for a lion to jump you, somehow grab it by its beard in midair, and thrust your knife into it. He probably had a swing that Babe Ruth would have been jealous of. And he clocked that lion or that bear with such force that it rolled and knocked over, and then he jumped it with his knife, grabbed it by the beard, and slit its throat, and the game was over. That's my theory. Nonetheless, we're not told exactly how it happened, but he was fearless because this was not your property. You have taken something that I'm responsible for, my father's sheep. And I'm going to stand for that. So David said, if I can do that, if God will watch me through that, certainly he'll take care of this. Because these bears and these lions did not insult God the way this Gentile has. Verse 36, "Your servant has killed both lion and bear. And this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, seeing he has defied the armies of the living God." Moreover, David said, "The Eternal And here's probably the best of the points that we'll have. David had great confidence in God. Oh, yes, he had personal confidence, but much more importantly, that personal confidence came from great confidence in God. Faith in God, we could put it that way. The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. And Saul said to David, I mean, Saul was so inspired by this, to see this passion, to see this loving God so deeply that he would stand for God at all personal risk. He was inspired. He said, go. Go and the eternal be with you. So as you know, David was given Saul's armor. David put it on, tried to walk. It doesn't fit right. I'm not trained in this. I need to be fast and light on my feet. Took the armor off. And it says then in verse 40, he took his staff in his hand, the one that he probably used to send the bear and the lion into outer space so they'd see stars, so he could use his sword or his knife to finish the job. And he chose for himself five smooth stones from the book. Not one, but five. He didn't know how many times he would have to hit this hulk of a man to put him down, but he knew he would. He put them in a shepherd's bag, in a pouch which he had. He was light, he was fast. It would be like lightning. His sling was in his hand. And he drew near to the Philistine. The Philistine came and began drawing near to David. Who went first? David went out first. So you see this line of Israelite soldiers. David walks out to defend God, knew in faith that God would take care of him. So out walks this kid. And so the murmur is on the Philistine line. Hey, someone's coming out. What do you know? And Goliath says, finally, we'll settle this, in essence. So the Philistine came and began drawing near to David. And the man who bore the shield went before him. So Goliath had his armor bearer, the shield bearer. Verse 42. When the Philistine looked around and saw David, he disdained him. Word means he belittled him. You little punk. Might be the kind of thing we would say, you little boy. Did mama change your diaper this morning? You know, who knows what he said? Probably things a lot ruder than that. He disdained him, for he was only a youth, ruddy and good looking. See, to be terrifying as a soldier, you couldn't have rosy cheeks. And you couldn't be good looking. You had to be ugly as sin to be intimidating. Scarred, battle-weary. Verse 43, so the Philistine said to David, am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? He's yelling at the army back there. Am I a dog? You send out this little stick like you're going to smack a little dog? The Philistine cursed David by his gods. That was the perfect thing for David to hear. The use of these other gods to curse the true God, curse the true God's armies. Verse 44, Philistine said to David, come to me and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and the beasts of the field. And David said to the Philistine, you come to me with a sword and with a spear and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Eternal of Hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defiled or defied. So David meant it. He was on fire in anger against the disrespect that this Gentile showed to God. This day, he said, the Lord will deliver you into my hand. I will strike you and take your head from you. And this day I will give the carcasses of the camp of the Philistines to the birds of the air and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel. Then all the assembly shall know that the Eternal does not save with sword and spear, for the battle is the Eternal's. He will give you into our hands. So it was. When the Philistine arose and came and drew near to meet David, that David, what did he do, run away? He ran directly at this hulk. He ran straight at him. David hurried and ran toward the army to meet the Philistine. David put his hand in his bag. He's running toward the giant. And while he's running, he puts his hand in his bag, takes out a stone, he slung it and struck the Philistine in his forehead. So you picture David running forward and this sling whizzing like a helicopter over his head, and he releases, and that stone goes directly in to the sweet spot, we might say. Struck the Philistine in his forehead so that the stone sank into his forehead. He fell on his face to the earth. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone and struck the Philistine and killed him. And there was no sword in the hand of David. Therefore David ran and stood over the Philistine, took his sword, drew it out of its sheath and killed him. Finished the job. Cut off his head with Goliath's own sword. And when the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. If this little kid, this teenager, can destroy the greatest soldier we've ever known, what are all those adults back there going to do? So they took off in fear, and rightly so. David had tremendous confidence in God. He trusted God without any question at all. If we can help our young people develop that kind of faith, a passion for God's way of life, a passion for the truth, we do them a great, great service. It brings us to the close of David's early life. His life would change dramatically after this point. Let's close by turning to 1 Timothy chapter 4. It's a word of admonition for all of our young people, and by extension, I suppose, to all of us. We have a few action steps for our young people. As we're turning to 1 Timothy, action step number one. If you're a young person, this week do something that your parents ask you to do. Just do it. Don't complain. Don't stop. Don't whine. Don't give an excuse. Just do it. Number two, if you're a young person, start something productive in your downtime. Start something productive in your downtime. Don't just fritter away free time. Make sure it's productive leisure. And number three, if you have a chance to defend God's honor this week, take that challenge and defend God's truth. Defend God. Stand up for your conviction with passion, with intent. We want others to know what we believe, that we feel strongly about it, that we know this is true, and we will follow through. 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 12, we'll close with this. I'll read to you from the New American Standard, very similar to the New King James. But it reads this way, "Let no man look down upon your youthfulness." Let no one look down on your youthfulness. How is that possible? You can't change your age, but when you do what Timothy is told here, people don't say, "Well, he's just a kid." What they say is, "Wow, what a fine young person." Let no one look down on your youthfulness, but rather in speech, conduct, love, faith, and purity, show yourself an example of those who believe. We are very proud of the young people that we have here in our congregation, and we look forward to helping them attain to the kingdom of God. So let's do our very best as a congregation to support and to love our next generation.